Chapter 4. Facts, and again facts are his unique concern. That is why he is not always properly understood. His facts are so perfectly rendered that, like the actualities of life itself, they demand from the reader the faculty of observation which is rare, the power of appreciation which is generally wanting in most of us who are guided mainly by empty phrases requiring no effort, demanding from us no qualities except a vague susceptibility to emotion. Nobody has ever gained the vast applause of a crowd by the simple and clear exposition of vital facts. Words alone strung upon a convention have fascinated us as worthless glass beads strung on a thread, have charmed at all times our brothers the unsophisticated savages of the islands. Now, Maupassant, of whom it has been said that he is the master of the MOT juiced, has never been a dealer in words. His wares have been, not glass beads, but polished gems, not the most rare and precious, perhaps, but of the very first water of their kind. That he took trouble with his gems, taking them up in the rough and polishing each facet patiently, the publication of the two posthumous volumes of short stories proves abundantly. I think it proves also the assertion made here, that he was by no means a dealer in words. On looking at the first feeble drafts from which so many perfect stories have been fashioned, one discovers that what has been matured, improved, brought to perfection by unwearied endeavor, is not the diction of the tale, but the vision of its true shape and detail. Those first attempts are not faltering or uncertain in expression. It is the conception which is at fault. The subjects have not yet been adequately seen. His proceeding was not to group expressive words that mean nothing around misty and mysterious shapes dear to muddled intellects and belonging neither to earth nor to heaven. His vision by a more scrupulous, prolonged and devoted attention to the aspects of the visible world discovered at last the right words, as if miraculously impressed for him upon the face of things and events. This was the particular shape taken by his inspiration. It came to him directly, honestly in the light of his day, not on the tortuous, dark roads of meditation. His realities came to him from a genuine source, from this universe of vain appearances wherein we men have found everything to make us proud, sorry, exalted, and humble. Maupassant's renown is universal, but his popularity is restricted. It is not difficult to perceive why. Maupassant is an intensely national writer. He is so intensely national in his logic, in his clearness, in his aesthetic and moral conceptions, that he has been accepted by his countrymen without having had to pay the tribute of flattery either to the nation as a whole, or to any class, sphere, or division of the nation. The truth of his art tells with an irresistible force, and he stands excused from the duty of patriotic posturing. He is a Frenchman of Frenchmen beyond question or cavil, and with that he is simple enough to be universally comprehensible. What is wanting to his universal success is the mediocrity of an obvious and appealing tenderness. He neglects to qualify his truth with a drop of facile sweetness. He forgets to strew paper roses over the tombs. The disregard of these common decencies lays him open to the charges of cruelty, cynicism, hardness. And yet it can be safely affirmed that this man wrote from the fullness of a compassionate heart. He is merciless, and yet gentle with his mankind. He does not rail at their prudent fears and their small artifices. He does not despise their labors. It seems to me that he looks with an eye of profound pity upon their troubles, deceptions and misery. But he looks at them all. He sees and does not turn away his head. As a matter of fact, he is courageous. Courage and justice are not popular virtues. The practice of strict justice is shocking to the multitude who always, perhaps from an obscure sense of guilt, attach to it the meaning of mercy. In the majority of us, who want to be left alone with our illusions, courage inspires a vague alarm. This is what is felt about Maupassant. His qualities, to use the charming and popular phrase, are not lovable. Courage being a force will not masquerade in the robes of affected delicacy and restraint. But if his courage is not of a chivalrous stamp, it cannot be denied that it is never brutal for the sake of effect. The writer of these few reflections, inspired by a long and intimate acquaintance with the work of the man, has been struck by the appreciation of Maupassant manifested by many women gifted with tenderness and intelligence. Their more delicate and audacious souls are good judges of courage. Their finer penetration has discovered his genuine masculinity without display, his virility without a pose. They have discerned in his faithful dealings with the world that enterprising and fearless temperament, poor in ideas, but rich in power, which appeals most to the feminine mind. It cannot be denied that he thinks very little. In him, extreme energy of perception achieves great results, as in men of action the energy of force and desire. His view of intellectual problems is perhaps more simple than their nature warrants. Still, a man who has written Yvette cannot be accused of want of subtlety. But one cannot insist enough upon this, that his subtlety, his humor, his grimness, though no doubt they are his own, are never presented otherwise but as belonging to our life, as found in nature, whose beauties and cruelties alike breathe the spirit of serene unconsciousness. Maupassant's philosophy of life is more temperamental than rational. He expects nothing from gods or men. He trusts his senses for information and his instinct for deductions. It may seem that he has made but little use of his mind. But let me be clearly understood. His sensibility is really very great, and it is impossible to be sensible unless one thinks vividly, unless one thinks correctly, starting from intelligible premises to an unsophisticated conclusion. This is literary honesty. It may be remarked that it does not differ very greatly from the ideal honesty of the respectable majority, from the honesty of lawgivers, of warriors, of kings, of bricklayers, of all those who express their fundamental sentiment in the ordinary course of their activities, by the work of their hands. The work of Maupassant's hands is honest. He thinks sufficiently to concrete his fearless conclusions in illuminative instances. He renders them with that exact knowledge of the means, and that absolute devotion to the aim of creating a true effect which is art. He is the most accomplished of narrators. It is evident that Maupassant looked upon his mankind in another spirit than those writers who make haste to submerge the difficulties of our holding place in the universe under a flood of false and sentimental assumptions. Maupassant was a true and dutiful lover of our earth. He says himself in one of his descriptive passages, "Aus Otters K. Sedulit La Terre." Dot it was true. The earth had for him a compelling charm. He looks upon her august and furrowed face with the fierce insight of real passion. His is the power of detecting the one immutable quality that matters in the changing aspects of nature and under the ever-shifting surface of life. To say that he could not embrace in his glance all its magnificence and all its misery is only to say that he was human. He lays claim to nothing that his matchless vision has not made his own. This creative artist has the true imagination. He never condescends to invent anything. He sets up no empty pretenses. And he stoops to no littleness in his art, least of all to the miserable vanity of a catching phrase. Anatole France 1904, Irene Quibille, the latest volume of M. Anatole France purports, by the declaration of its title page, to contain several profitable narratives. The story of Crane Quibille's encounter with human justice stands at the head of them. A tale of a well-bestowed charity closes the book with a touch of playful irony characteristic of the writer on whom the most distinguished amongst his literary countrymen have conferred the rank of Prince of Prose. Never has a dignity been better born. M. Anatole France is a good prince. He knows nothing of tyranny, but much of compassion. The detachment of his mind from common errors and current superstitions befits the exalted rank he holds in the commonwealth of literature. It is just to suppose that the clamor of the tribes in the forum had little to do with his elevation. Their elect are of another stamp. They are such as their need of precipitate action requires, He is the elect of the Senate of Letters, whose conscript fathers have recognized him as primus inter pares, a post of pure honor, and of no privilege. It is a good choice. First, because it is just, and next, because it is safe. The dignity will suffer no diminution in M. Anatole France's hands. He is worthy of a great tradition, learned in the lessons of the past, concerned with the present, and as earnest as to the future as a good prince should be in his public action. It is a republican dignity. And M. Anatole France, with his skeptical insight into and forms of government, is a good republican. He is indulgent to the weaknesses of the people, and perceives that political institutions, whether contrived by the wisdom of the few, or the ignorance of the many, are incapable of securing the happiness of mankind. He perceives this truth in the serenity of his soul, and in the elevation of his mind. He expresses his convictions with measure, restraint and harmony, which are indeed princely qualities. He is a great analyst of illusions. He searches and probes their innermost recesses, as if they were realities made of an eternal substance. And there consists his humanity. This is the expression of his profound and unalterable compassion. He will flatter no tribe, no section in the forum or in the marketplace. His lucid thought is not beguiled into false pity or into the common weakness of affection. He feels that men born in ignorance as in the house of an enemy, and condemned to struggle with error and passions through endless centuries, should be spared the supreme cruelty of a hope forever deferred. He knows that our best hopes are irrealizable, that it is the almost incredible misfortune of mankind, but also its highest privilege, to aspire towards the impossible, that men have never failed to defeat their highest aims by the very strength of their humanity which can conceive the most gigantic tasks, but leaves them disarmed before their irremediable littleness. He knows this well, because he is an artist and a master, but he knows too, that only in the continuity of effort there is a refuge from despair for minds less clear-seeing and philosophic than his own. Therefore he wishes us to believe and to hope, preserving in our activity the consoling illusion of power and intelligent purpose. He is a good and politic prince. The majesty of justice is contained entire in each sentence pronounced by the judge in the name of the sovereign people. Jerome Crinquebille, hawker of vegetables, became aware of the august aspect of the law as he stood indicted before the tribunal of the higher police court on a charge of insulting a constable of the force. With this exposition, begins the first tale of M. Anatole France's latest volume. The bust of the Republic and the image of the crucified Christ appear side by side above the bench occupied by the President Birch and his two assessors. All the laws divine and human are suspended over the head of Crinquebille. From the first visual impression of the accused and of the court, the author passes by a characteristic and natural turn to the historical and moral significance of those two emblems of state and religion whose accord is only possible to the confused reasoning of an average man. But the reasoning of M. Anatole France is never confused. His reasoning is clear, and informed by a profound erudition. Such is not the case of Crinquebille, a street hawker, charged with insulting the constituted power of society in the person of a policeman. The charge is not true, nothing was further from his thoughts. But, amazed by the novelty of his position, he does not reflect that the cross on the wall perpetuates the memory of a sentence which for 1900 years all the Christian peoples have looked upon as a grave miscarriage of justice. He might well have challenged the president to pronounce any sort of sentence, if it were merely to 48 hours of simple imprisonment, in the name of the crucified Redeemer. He might have done so. But Crinquebille, who has lived pushing every day for half a century his hand barrow loaded with vegetables through the streets of Paris, has not a philosophic mind. Truth to say, he has nothing. He is one of the disinherited. Properly speaking, he has no existence at all, or, to be strictly truthful, he had no existence to Anatole France's philosophic mind, and human sympathy have called him up from his nothingness for our pleasure, and, as the title page of the book has it, no doubt for our profit also. Therefore we behold him in the dock, a stranger to all historical, political, or social considerations which can be brought to bear upon his case. He remains lost in astonishment. Penetrated with respect, overwhelmed with awe, he is ready to trust the judge upon the question of his transgression. In his conscience he does not think himself culpable, but M. Anatole France's philosophical mind discovers for us that he feels all the insignificance of such a thing as the conscience of a mere street hawker in the face of the symbols of the law and before the ministers of social repression. Crinquebille is innocent. But already the young advocate, his defender, has half persuaded him of his guilt. On this phrase practically ends the introductory chapter of the story which, as the author's dedication states, has inspired an admirable draftsman and a skillful dramatist, each in his art, to a vision of tragic grandeur. And this opening chapter without a name consisting of 2.5 pages, some 400 words at most, is a masterpiece of insight and simplicity, resumed in M. Anatole France's distinction of thought, and in his princely command of words. It is followed by 6 more short chapters, concise and full, delicate and complete like the petals of a flower, presenting to us the adventure of Crinquebille before the justice, an apology for the president of the tribunal, of the submission of Crinquebille to the laws of the republic, of his attitude before the public opinion, and so on to the chapter of the last consequences. We see, created for us in his outward form and innermost perplexity, the old man degraded from his high estate of a law-abiding street hawker and driven to insult, really this time, the majesty of the social order in the person of another police constable. It is not an act of revolt, and still less of revenge. Crinquebille is too old, too resigned, too weary, too guileless to raise the black standard of insurrection. He is cold and homeless and starving. He remembers the warmth and the food of the prison. He perceives the means to get back there. Since he has been locked up, he argues with himself, for uttering words which, as a matter of fact, he did not say, he will go forth now, and to the first policeman he meets, will say those very words in order to be imprisoned again. Thus reasons Crinquebille with simplicity and confidence. He accepts facts. Nothing surprises him. But all the phenomena of social organization and of his own life remain for him mysterious to the end. The description of the policeman in his short cape and hood, who stands quite still under the light of a street lamp at the edge of the pavement, shining with the wet of a rainy autumn evening along the whole extent of a long and deserted thoroughfare, is a perfect piece of imaginative precision. From under the edge of the hood his eyes look upon Crinquebille, who has just uttered in an uncertain voice the sacramental, insulting phrase of the popular slang Mordox Vatches. They look upon him shining in the deep shadow of the hood with an expression of sadness, vigilance, and contempt. He does not move. Crinquebille, in a feeble and hesitating voice, repeats once more the insulting words. But this policeman is full of philosophic superiority, disdain, and indulgence. He refuses to take in charge the old and miserable vagabond who stands before him shivering and ragged in the drizzle. And the ruined Crinquebille, victim of a ridiculous miscarriage of justice, appalled at this magnanimity, passes on hopelessly down the street full of shadows, where the lamps gleam each in a ruddy halo of falling mist. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.